06 AP 1886, Brittany L. Nofke versus Kevin Bakke. Arguments will be made in the following order. 15 minutes for Tracy Toole, representing Nofke. 15 minutes of Peggy Van Horn, representing the high school and the insurance company. 3 minutes for Mr. Toole in rebuttal, and 15 minutes from James Naugler, representing Bakke and American Family. 15 minutes of Tracy Toole, representing Nofke, and 3 minutes rebuttal by Naugler. Everybody's going to be up and down quite quickly in arguing this case. Is that the agreement of counsel? All right. You may proceed, Mr. Toole.
Thank you. May it please the court, I represent Brittany Nofke. This petition concerns discretionary immunity. We contend that the lower courts should not have applied discretionary immunity in this case to protect the negligent acts of the cheerleading coach. She directed these minor students who were inexperienced in a dangerous stunt to attempt the stunt without making sure there was an adequate spotter, without making sure there were mats or other safety precautions, without directly supervising them herself, and without giving them any sort of training as to the proper method of safety. The coach knew that in stunts like this, students are going to fall. She knew it's dangerous, and she knew it was important to have a spotter there. But when these students attempted the stunt, Brittany Nofke did what she was supposed to do. She didn't do anything wrong. When the stunt became unstable, she stayed tight. She fell backwards into the arms of a spotter who was supposed to be there, but there was no spotter there, and she was seriously injured, and she sustained a skull fracture as a result of this accident. Sovereign immunity was abrogated for municipalities in 1962 by this court, and the court said that the rule is liability, the exception is immunity. That principle was confirmed again in Kimps versus Hill in footnote 6 in 1996. You said that the difference between immunity of a state actor and a municipal actor, like we have here, is that for the municipal actor, liability remains the rule and immunity is to be the exception to the rule. You have further said that discretionary immunity for a municipal actor is a waivable affirmative defense in the Anderson versus City of Milwaukee case. So what we have here is a situation where the lower court in this case has essentially put the burden on the plaintiff to show that there is no immunity, rather than following the rule that immunity is to be the exception and requiring the school district to prove up its affirmative defense by establishing that it is immune. In the Willow Creek case, the majority of you said in paragraph 25 that discretion requires the exercise of judgment. At a minimum, there should be some inquiry as to whether the school district and its actor, Coach Phillips, exercised judgment in what she did, and there was no attempt to make that showing in this case, no discussion of those facts. We have focused on two of the exceptions to discretionary immunity. The first is the ministerial act exception. In many cases, starting with probably Lister, you have said that a ministerial act is one where the command is absolute and certain and imperative and directs the state actor, the municipal actor, as to the time, mode, and occasion. In other words, how I take it is, there's got to be some specific rule telling them what to do. In this case, we have a set of spirit rules. These are rules that were adopted by a national federation. A member of that national federation is the Wisconsin Interscholastic Athletic Association, which is a nonprofit voluntary organization. But if the schools that have athletic programs subscribe to the Wisconsin Association, they agree to be bound by the rules of that entity. The spirit rules adopted by the National Federation come through that state association and are official as the standards of behavior for Coach Phillips in this case. This is not a case where the parties presented conflicting ideas of what the standard of care is, where we offered rules from a variety of sources or expert witnesses talking about what would be reasonable. We have the spirit rules. We have Coach Phillips, who says that these are the rules that govern her behavior.
Mr. Toole, can I interrupt you for a moment? Would you remind me and all of us of the circumstances here, and especially how those circumstances would relate to these spirit rules? Are the spirit rules applicable only where there's a performance? Are they applicable only where there's a practice? Or just when are they to be applied?
The spirit rules say that they are applicable to all of the activities of the activity. They're not limited to games or practice. The spirit rules are explicitly say that they cover.
Now, was this a practice before a performance, before a game?
This was a warm-up in the commons area of Pullman High School before a basketball game. So these students were going to go in and cheer and apparently do stunts as part of the basketball game, and they were warming up. The specific rule that I would point to in regard to one that Coach Phillips simply did not follow, did not exercise any judgment in deciding not to follow, is Rule 2, Section 4 of the Spirit Rules. It says spotters are required until a stunt is mastered. These students had never tried this stunt before. Kevin Bakke had never tried this stunt. The other two were inexperienced. It certainly wasn't mastered. Spotters were required. The same rule says an inattentive person is not considered a spotter. Kevin, in this case, did not pay attention to his responsibility. He did not go back and spot.
Just because he didn't pay attention, does it necessarily follow that there wasn't a spotter that was provided for this attempted stunt?
Well, I would point to the rule, Rule 2, Section 4, I believe it's Article 2, that says an inattentive person is not considered a spotter.
Well, someone just standing around and being inattentive could be different than someone who was assigned specifically to spot and simply didn't do his job.
But the rule goes on to say that the spotter must be in proper position, meaning behind the stunt.
So you're saying if the coach assigns a spotter and the spotter is standing to the side of the stunt rather than behind the person being elevated, that there is no spotter? That's essentially your argument.
I would say that, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Counsel, is there anything in the record to indicate that the spotter, Mr. Bakke, had been inattentive at any point prior to the immediacy which occurred at the time of Ms. Nofty's fall?
There is nothing in the record to suggest inattention. There is nothing in the record to suggest he'd been trained on what he was supposed to do.
And at the time, concurrent with Ms. Nofty's fall from the top of the shoulders of the other student, others, and I don't know if the record identifies who they are specifically, were shouting for Bakke to get into the proper position. Is that a fair characterization?
That's fair. The same set of spirit rules state that the presence of a spotter is the coach's responsibility. One of the central tenets of the definition of a ministerial duty appears to be whether it is specific enough, such that discretion is not reasonably to be exercised. Under those rules, it doesn't leave room for Coach Phillips to decide among competing alternatives. It doesn't say spotters are required until a stunt is mastered, unless it's a warm-up for a basketball game, unless there's a high school junior involved, unless the coach feels that the conditions are appropriate not to use a spotter. There are no alternatives within that rule to allow the coach to choose from. The rule sets up a specific mode and occasion for what the coach is supposed to do, make sure a spotter is there, and there wasn't one.
Counsel, I'm looking at the rules. Rule 2, Article 4. Let me read it. stunts, mounts, pyramids, tosses, and tumblings must be modified to be appropriate to the performing surface area. Specifically, does that rule meet the ministerial test that it's stated in a definite, certain term, leaving nothing to discretion?
Does that rule in and of itself? I would say in and of itself, it does not.
How does this rule interface with the argument regarding the matting?
The matting, there's a separate rule that suggests that there should be appropriate matting under the circumstances. And
what rule is that? Could you assist me if you know? That's okay. This is not of great. I'll move on to another one. Spotting, section 4. A spotter must be in the proper position. That's what you referred to earlier. Sometimes when I talk, I use the word, all things must be appropriate. And I do that intentionally because I know appropriate is a squishy word. A spotter must be in the proper position. Sounds like a pretty squishy word too, doesn't it?
The rule defines, I believe, what the proper position
is. With arms extended toward the top person's head, shoulders to prevent injuries.
Yes. Yes. I would suggest that is a very specific definition of the proper position for a spotter.
Fair enough.
Mm-hmm. The rule, Your Honor, on matting, I believe, is Rule 2, Section 1, and it refers to appropriate matting. With regard to that, I would say that after now a couple of years and reading Ms. Van Horn's discussions of this issue and that the rule with regard to matting that says appropriate matting, I would have to concede that appropriate matting is more discretionary sounding language than is the spotting rule. But appropriate matting still does not mean that it's absolutely immune no matter what the state actor does.
Isn't the record indicate that sometimes bare asphalt can be proper matting?
Your Honor, I'm not sure what portion of the record you're referring to, but
the spirit rules.
There are, I would agree that there are situations apparently where there could be no matting, and that could be within a coach's.
For instance, at a football game, typically high school football fields, it's not uncommon for them to be located on the center of a track. Those tracks are typically constructed out of some form of asphalt.
Sure. Right.
Can you help me out with the idea that this goes beyond simple negligence to reckless conduct? Baki's conduct isn't just simple negligence, being in the wrong place. It goes beyond that to reckless. Where are the facts that support that? Where was the circuit court judge wrong?
And the petition issue with relation to Mr. Baki, Mr. Nagler, I'm sure will comment on more, but my focus on that is that recklessness, this court has defined in the Listina case to include acting without intent to injure, but in a manner so unreasonably dangerous that the actor knows or should know it is highly probable harm will result. He knew, as Justice Gableman pointed out, there's evidence in the record, everyone was telling Mr. Baki, you've got to get behind them. He knew he was supposed to, and he knew that it's dangerous not to have a spotter there, especially when his classmate is standing on the shoulders of another student and she's falling backwards. So what I would contend is that knowing of the danger and knowing that it's a serious physical danger and that he's supposed to act brings that within the concept of recklessness, or at least a jury could so find.
So if the plaintiff would have fallen forward, unfortunately, but fell forward, then there wouldn't be recklessness. But because the spotter was forward and not backward, there's recklessness.
I would say that would be an issue of causation, and we'd have to ask why she fell forward instead of backward. On the facts of that case, that would be a different case. In cases that I have reviewed where this court has found no ministerial duty, generally the standards are a lot more general that have been pointed to than the specific Rule 2, Section 4 standard that Nofke has pointed to in this case. On the issue of discretion, I wanted to use one example. In a situation where there is no speed limit to drive a boat on a lake, if I'm a state actor in a boat, I could say I have discretion to drive as fast as I want. But if I drive 100 miles an hour in the dark on the 4th of July when people are out on the lake, a reasonable judge could find that that is not a discretionary action. So merely the phrasing within the rule, the matting rule, for example, is not determinative of whether this was a non-discretionary act or a discretionary act.
Well, I think, are you referring implicitly to the known clear present danger standard?
Well, right there I was referring to back to the matting issue. The known and present.
But you were doing that in connection with making an argument that that would be a known present clear danger, I think.
In answer to that, I would say the known danger is a separate issue that we have covered in our brief.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Van Horn. Can I tell us, Ms. Van Horn, what issue you're going to argue so that we are focused?
May it please the court, my name is Peggy Van Horn. I'm representing the Holman School District, Holman High School, and Wausau Underwriters Insurance Company. And I'm going to be representing the school district. I'm going to be arguing solely on the issue of the discretionary immunity issues. I'm not going to be addressing the contact sport issue because that issue is solely an issue between the plaintiff and Mr. Bakke.
So you're talking about 893.80 sub 4?
That's correct, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Public officer immunity arises from common law and is founded on policy considerations that balance the need of a public officer to exercise its duties independently versus the right of an injured person to recover for injuries. And in the cases, there's five public policy considerations that are often recited. And in this case, I believe that two of those are particularly important. The first one is the deterrent effect that the threat of personal liability might have on those considering entering public service. This case involves a cheerleading coach in a public school, and throughout Wisconsin, extracurricular sporting activities are expanding all the time, and the need for community members to volunteer their time as coaches and assistant coaches is ever growing. Coaches, either they get paid a very small amount of money or they don't get paid at all. And they do it, they commit a large amount of time because of their love for the particular sport and an enjoyment of working with the students. And I think that public policy consideration needs to be kept in mind when we go forward and talk about the specific issues. The second public policy issue that I also think is important here is the danger of influencing public officers in the exercise of their responsibilities and obligations by the threat of a lawsuit. And again, in this case, with sporting activities, there is a pressure on coaches and, you know, by society, by parents, to get the best, to have all of our students performing at their peak performance. And the threat of a lawsuit, knowing that you may be sued if somebody's injured, may cause some coaches to not or to accept less than peak performance from the students that they are coaching. So those are the two public policy issues that I think are particularly relevant in this case. Now, going on to talk about the particulars of discretionary immunity, Section 893.80 sub 4, the first issue is whether the spirit rules impose ministerial or discretionary duties on the coach. And
could I ask a question, sure, about the statute? your coach, what part of the statute are you relying on for her conduct? Was it was she performing a legislative or a quasi-legislative function?
I believe it's more quasi-judicial. I believe that her role here is she was to take these spirit rules, interpret them, and apply them to the fact situation that she had. And for that reason, I think it's important that we look at the entirety of these spirit rules, not pulling out one particular section. And starting with the issue of the matting, there are the sections that say that matting should be used in appropriate situations. Appropriate matting should be used in practices and performances. But then there's also the situation rulings where it specifically says that you can do stunting on asphalt, which clearly is a no-matting situation. So when you look at the spirit rules as a whole, I think that my coach was forced to take these spirit rules as a whole, look at her situation. I have a, you know, we have to warm up before a basketball game. They were kicked out of one room, moved to another room. They have about 10 or 15 minutes to do theirs. The students, there is a need for them to do some of these stunts without mats because they need to get over the fear of it, because once they're on the basketball court, there's not going to be mats. So there is a lot of issues that this coach has to take into consideration, and I think that's what makes this the exercise of discretion.
She was performing a quasi-judicial function in interpreting those rules. Was she required to apply those rules?
I believe as the coach, she was required to make the decisions as to where the students should do their stunting and where they should do their practices.
But the quasi-judicial function is tied to the interpretation of those rules?
Correct. And I believe that this coach took these rules and applied them to her fact situation.
But I think the original question was, must these rules be followed? I mean, as part of being in this group, must they be followed? Did she have to follow these rules?
I believe that the rules were guidelines, and the rules themselves set forth the fact that they are guidelines that apply to various different situations. And they aren't specific. I mean, did she have to follow them? I don't believe that she had to follow them. She chose to follow them.
So her interpretation of rules that she didn't have to follow, in your view, gives her immunity?
If there are no rules, and there would be no ministerial duty, if there is no specific act that she's required to apply, there would be no ministerial duty. And so I believe that would be the case. If she chose not to apply these rules, she would definitely have discretion, because in that situation there would be no discretion at all. And I think that by choosing to apply these rules does not necessarily mean that these rules become a ministerial duty, when the rules in and of themselves allow for discretion. And one of the cases that Ms. Nofke cited in their reply brief was the Slinger versus WIAA, and the facts are a little bit different on the case, but what was interesting to me in that case is at the end of it, the Court of Appeals was talking about the WIAA rules, and it noted that there were some parts of the rules that could be interpreted as being mandatory in the language, using the words must and should. And yet the Court of Appeals noted, when you looked at the overall WIAA rules, they clearly were intended to give the board wide discretion in how to apply those rules. And I think that's similar to the situation that we have here, that the rules in their total they're guidelines, and they do give the coach wide discretion on how to apply them in a particular situation.
Does it make any sense to you as a matter of public policy that the school district and the employees of the school district are potentially exempt from or immune from any liability, but individual students can get socked with liability.
I don't think school districts are certainly not immune from liability in all situations. I think that's the whole issue. If there's a ministerial duty and it's violated, the school district is certainly responsible. And as to liability of the individual students, to be honest, that's not an issue that I have been involved in at all on this case. And I simply can't address that. It's not an issue that has been raised by or against the school district.
I don't really understand your last answer. Isn't there a question for the school district about the spirit rules and whether there was or was not a spotter? Isn't that
part? Oh, absolutely. Right.
And what is your response to the argument I heard about the fact that this young man wasn't really a spotter?
I believe the provisions of the spirit rules indicate that a spotter should be provided until a stunt is mastered. And in addition, the coach testified that this particular stunt is not a stunt that typically requires a spotter. But in this case, there was a spotter. Kevin Bakke was provided solely for the purpose, you know, that was his role. Once Ms. Nofke was positioned, his role was to act as a spotter. And I think in that regard, the duty of the coach to provide a spotter has been satisfied by Kevin Bakke's presence.
If you provide a negligent spotter, is there a spotter?
I think that if the coach was aware of a perhaps that Kevin Bakke had a history of inattentiveness or a history of negligence in that regard. But what we have in this situation is everything. He was attentive. He was paying attention. Everything was going right to essentially the instant of the accident. And in that situation,
was he in the right spot?
I don't believe he was.
Wasn't going right.
Well, it was going. What I'm trying to say is it was all. It was he wasn't inattentive until he was in the wrong spot and she fell. Was that one second, 2 seconds? I'm not exactly sure. But prior to that, there was no evidence of Mr. Bakke being negligent, nor even at the moment of the incident, the coach certainly was not aware of any negligence on the part of Bakke. So it's difficult to say. I think that from any standpoint, a coach that has no information of a student with a propensity for inappropriate spotting, that she wouldn't have it would not be negligence to provide a spotter who has a history of good behavior. It perhaps there might be a problem if there was some history of inappropriate spotting that was performed.
I'd like to come back to a question that had been asked by Justice Prosser a few minutes ago, and that is in regard to the rules. Mr. Toole, during his first portion of oral arguments, suggested that the school district, and therefore Coach Phillips, was bound to follow these rules, however discretionary, so to speak, they may be. Do you take a contrary position? Does your client take a contrary position? And if so, why?
I interpret your question as asking whether we believe that these spirit rules are imposed by law on the school district.
Or by some other means, yes.
Right. And at the trial court level and at the Court of Appeals, that was an issue that we didn't take into consideration. For purposes of summary judgment at the trial court and in the Court of Appeals, we were presuming, for the purposes of those arguments, that the spirit rules were imposed. Toole raised that issue here in his briefs to the Supreme Court, and the reality of it is that these rules were not formally adopted by the school district. The Meyer case, which is a Court of Appeals case, made it very clear that to be imposed by law requires an act of government. And in this case, there's no evidence that the school board or even at any level adopted these rules such that they would be considered imposed by law.
So is that your first argument, and then your second argument would be, even if there was some imposition, the rules are so discretionary that Coach Phillips was well within her discretion?
Those are the two arguments, and yes. Very briefly, I want to talk about the known and present danger exception. And if there is immunity in this case, I don't believe the known and present danger exception applies for three reasons. First of all, I don't believe that there was a particularly dangerous situation. Now, to you or to me, certainly stunting would be very dangerous, but these are students that were certainly by December 17th of 2004, the plaintiff was quite skilled at this. All of the participants, the coach and all of the students, agreed that this particular stunt was a relatively easy level stunt. So for that reason, I don't think the known and present danger exception applies, because this particular stunt for these students and for this coach was not a particularly dangerous situation. The second reason that I believe that the known and present danger exception does not apply is that there is no specific non-discretionary response required. The plaintiff has alleged there should be mats, there should have been an extra spotter. You know, there's a various events or options that the coach had available to her that I think for that reason the known and present danger exception would not apply. And the third reason I think that the known and present danger exception would not apply is that I don't think that the known danger, that the danger in the situation was particularly known to the coach. The situation here was that the plaintiff apparently had not done this stunt with these people before. In the depositions, it's very clear that the coach, as well as one of the participants, had understood that Ms. Nofke had done this stunt, was familiar with this, and that this was not anything unusual. For that reason, I believe that the known and present danger defense would not apply, because in this particular situation, the danger was not something that was known with particularity to the coach.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you. Mr. Toole.
Thank you. Ms. Van Horn isolated two of the policies behind immunity that she believes apply in this case. Those were the deterrent effect on persons entering public service and the fear of a lawsuit. Now, those concerns apply when we're talking about actual legislators and actual judges, but those concerns don't apply very well when we're talking about employees, coaches of local municipalities. How is a coach in a public school different from a coach in a private school? By this rationale, you're applying immunity to a public school coach without treating a private school coach or teacher the same way. There is no special burden to acting without negligence and using due and ordinary care when a person is in the position of an employee or a coach. These are not situations where the person is required to balance competing public interests, resolve disputes among litigants or constituents, make decisions on public policy. She simply has to use due care and follow the rules. So those policy purposes behind immunity don't apply here. Secondly, when we're talking about the totality of the circumstances in this case, so far today we've been debating ministerial and discretionary, but the totality of the circumstances are strongly on par with the Voss decision that came out recently while our case is pending. The facts are indistinguishably bad as Voss. Voss was dangerous, so was this. The special response that was required was to use a safety measure such as spotting, but in whatever needs to be done to make sure that the students are safe. And certainly the coach testified that she knew that this was dangerous and that spotters are required. So on these facts, I ask you to consider that it would be fair to go forward and let a jury decide whether liability should be imposed on the school district. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. If cross appeal here of Bakke versus Nofke, and Mr. Nauger is going to argue for 15 minutes, also for Kevin Bakke and American Family Mutual Insurance Company.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is James Nogler. I represent Kevin Bakke, who at that time was a 14-year-old boy, an American family. My grandmother immigrated from Prince Edward Island in Canada. My father immigrated from Nova Scotia, Canada. Neither one had a high school degree. They had four children. Two were chemical engineers. One of those was my father. When he was in high school, he wanted to play football. This is in the 30s. My grandmother said, no, I don't want you injured. Fast forward to 1993, and let's say my father approached my grandmother and said, I want to play soccer. And now she's got to contemplate injuries. She's got to contemplate whether to buy a plup and if they can afford one. She's got to contemplate, because it's simple carelessness at this juncture, that if the damages are too big in a suit with children suing each other, that they could lose their home. Now, let's go to 1995. The legislature is looking at this issue. And they draft a statute, and that's why we're here. And it says, rather simply, physical contact, and this is where the recklessness standard applies, physical contact between persons in a sport and recreational teams. And those recreational teams, municipal, high school, college, that statute now reads, physical contact between opponents in a competitive sport involving amateur teams. And the Court of Appeals found the language physical contact ambiguous because they said, well, you know, where do we draw the line? And I would submit that that's a very good issue, because instead of redrawing the line, they redrew the statute. And the two tests, which are commonly used, I think, with cases across the country addressing this issue, is to draw lines, to know where you're going, is whether or not physical contact is an inherent part of the sport. And there's no question here, in the case of cheerleading, it's an inherent part of the sport. Bakke, Hall, both testified. 90% of the time, he's lifting, tossing, turning, twisting. Ditto for Hall. The next test, is there a foreseeable risk of injury? Now, if you apply both of these tests, you can eliminate golf. You can eliminate chess. You can eliminate virtually anything that comes down the pike. Coach Phillips said, and we've talked about this, that the stunts are dangerous, that cheerleading is like wrestling, kids get hurt, stunts have risks, and falls are foreseeable. The next issue is whether or not, because the statute clearly eliminates it, it doesn't have opponent or competition. In the caption, you have, so I'm correct on here.
Counsel, while you're looking for that, in your recitation of the statute, you indicated that 895.525.4M provides immunity for a recreational activity that includes physical contact between, and then you used the word opponents.
Now, I meant to use persons. I misspoke.
It is big difference. I'm not trying to.
No. And I, Justice, I'm glad for the correction. And I misspoke. I meant to say physical contact between persons. It's been changed to physical contact between opponents. And that's the gravamen of my case here.
You're saying that the Court of Appeals, in essence, has changed it to.
They redrafted the statute.
Yeah.
Respectfully. Thank you for bringing that to my attention. In terms of. The Court of Appeals went to liability of contact sports participants, and from there they got competitors and they got opponents. The statute itself defines what a contact sport is. A contact sport is physical contact between persons in a sport involving recreational teams.
It's amateur teams, but it doesn't matter.
Right. That's what I use for recreational. There's some comments about, and this is a concern, and I'll just try to address these issues at random, about the fact that this was a warm-up and not an actual participation. And in that respect, I would direct the court's attention to Savino v. Robinson, which is an Illinois case cited in the briefs. And that case involved hockey, and it was a warm-up for hockey. The puck went in the air during the warm-up and hit someone's eye. Counsel argued that the warm-up was negligence, the hockey was a contact sport, and that was recklessness, and the court said, that's simply illusory. I mean, a contact sport is a contact sport, whether it's warm-up or whether it's the sport. Finally, the policy reasons, which would be, in this particular case, high risk of injury accompanied by with physical contact, balancing the free and vigorous participation, and the chilling effect, which I referred to earlier, which parents have to decide. Since it came up in oral argument earlier on when you were discussing ministerial duties, the recklessness versus negligence, and I'll just touch on that very briefly.
I didn't understand that.
I'm sorry. It came up in earlier argument, recklessness versus negligence. It's a negligence standard here for the following reasons. Number one, this could be a two-person stunt, and that's what the coach said. They happened to have a spotter there. Number two, Kevin Bakke had never been trained in this particular sport. Number three, the responsibility, the primary responsibility, is not on Kevin Bakke, even though he's a spotter. The primary responsibility is Ms. Nofke, who's up on the shoulders hanging on. And what the coach said in the deposition is that she was surprised that Ms. Nofke did not fall forward, because she can see Kevin Bakke right there if she's lost her balance, but she's in control. They're holding on hands. She makes the decision if she's in the balance. And she knew there was nobody behind her.
Oh, are you telling us that she purposely fell backwards?
No. Just like the coach described, it was an accident, it was negligence, it was not
recklessness. Right, but I don't see how the fall was within her control. I think at least the record appeared to me to show that she fell through whatever, losing her balance. But when you lose your balance, just by force of losing it, you don't have control over how you're going to fall.
I agree with you, Justice. The point I wanted to make was it's negligence, not recklessness.
It's negligence, not what?
Excuse me. It's negligence, not recklessness. I guess there's no crime for finishing early if there's no questions.
That you want to get it under negligence because you don't want to get it under 895.525-4M.
That is absolutely correct, Chief Justice.
That's your legal argument here.
That is correct.
What's wrong with what the Court of Appeals did in saying, you know, when people talk about contact sports, they normally talk about things like football and hockey and sports where there's regular physical contact, and somehow or other, and I know they looked at the title of the statute as well, but somehow or another, cheerleading doesn't seem to come to mind as a contact sport. What's your response to that?
My response is twofold. Number one, it's definitely a contact sport because it's 90% of the time is physical contact. The spirit rules, which everybody was referring to, are replete with references to physical contact. Number three, that's what the statute says. And number four, these are highly dangerous stunts that can result in a lot of injuries to the point where it's in published newspapers, Washington Post, talking about the dangers and hazards of cheerleading. This is a very dangerous sport.
And as to whether it is a sport, you speak to that?
Sure. I don't think anybody, neither the trial court nor the Court of Appeals had any trouble finding that this was a sport. It involves skill. It involves a degree of talent. It involves risk. It involves physical activity. It involves training. And sport is a broad term, and sport can involve both teams and individuals. In this case, the statute requires that they be amateur teams.
Why is it not reasonable to infer from the language of the statute that it means between persons in a sport involving amateur teams, competing amateur teams? Why isn't that?
I don't see competition there, and I know that came up in the oral discussion in the trial judges. He asked that question: does the word competition appear anywhere in the statute? The answer is it doesn't.
No, and that's why I use the word infer, because right. It's not there. Why isn't it reasonable to infer
I don't
that?
Think you go there, because I don't think the statute is ambiguous. The legislature made the determination that this is how we're describing a contact sport: physical contact between persons, not opponents, not competitors, in a sport, recreational teams.
It's a competition to get on the cheerleading squad?
Competition's coming up, and I'll just address that. So I'll take the hypothetical that competition is important here. It's not in the statute, but you have competition in cheerleading. First off, you have to try out. You have to get accepted. There are cheerleading contests all the time. You can see them on TV if you're channel surfing and you go to Junk Sports. There they are, the cheerleaders competing. And the cheerleaders are competing on the field with each other to see who can do the best stunts, who can show off the best. So competition is there. And courts have been pretty liberal on how they've ruled on competition. For example, they've found the recklessness standard applies to kick the can. So competition can come in different forms rather than direct physical contact. Thank you.
Courts have found that.
Does Prosser, do you have a question?
I didn't know courts had ruled on kick the can. No, that's
it's cited in our brief. Kick the can would be Marchetti v. Kalish.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you. This sports immunity statute is an exception to the rule of negligence. Lestina is the law before this exception is applied. Lestina said that negligence would cover the tort liability among co-participants in a sports activity. Mr. Nogler has focused heavily on the specific language of this provision, arguing that it is not ambiguous. Looking at that specific language, the immunity here applies to physical contact between persons in a sport involving amateur teams. Teams is a plural word. Where's the other team? The language in this statute, I think, pretty clearly communicates a competition element. And that's been a conclusion that was quite properly reached by the Court of Appeals in this case and by courts that have considered similar questions on the common law and similar provisions throughout this country.
Counselor, what if this had been the high school basketball team instead of the cheerleaders? And they were in practice, and the coach was teaching them to run a new play. And when they did so, two of the players on their own team collided with each other, and one suffered a serious head injury because of the way he hit the floor. Would that statute apply to that circumstance or not, in your opinion?
In my opinion, it would apply. I would say that basketball is a contact sport and that the nature of the sport involves competition among amateur teams.
Okay, but they wouldn't be competing, so it doesn't matter to you whether at the moment of the injury there was competition, only that the sport was subject to competition in the usual course of participating. Am I right on what you're distinguishing?
My distinction is based on the nature of the sport.
Okay, thank you.
Counsel,
Mr. Toole, please go ahead, Justice.
Thank you. Counsel, the legislature chose the word involving. Involving is a broader word. It's kind of what I call one of those squishy words, isn't it? And why involving as opposed to between or among?
My opinion, again, is that the legislature was drafting so as not to create too narrow of a time-lock definition of contact sport. Back in a time, contact sports meant football, rugby, hockey, perhaps. We have a lot of other sports that more people are playing today. Lacrosse is more popular, and there are evolving concepts of what is a contact sport. But there still is the nature that there has to be competition involved.
Well, there is an interpretation here. Physical contact between persons in a sport involving amateur teams. Does being a cheerleader for a team, let's say a basketball team, physical contact between persons in the sport of cheerleading, which necessarily involves amateur or another team. In other words, you have to cheerlead for something. You know, by very definition, you are involved in a team. I mean, what about that interpretation?
In the couple of years that I've lived with this case, that's the first time I've heard that interpretation. It doesn't come naturally to at least this reader of the language. I think that the participant has to be involved in the sport, not just cheering on some other competitive sport. I think that's the clear inference from the language. It also follows from the background of where the statute grew from. It grew as a response to Lestina and Justice Wilcox's dissent in Lestina, where he was talking about contact sports. It's evident in the Legislative Bureau's history and in the background of the statute.
Mr. Toole, it does seem to me that you have several times now pointed to Lestina as controlling this situation. Have I heard that accurately?
If this statute does not apply,
right,
then this falls under the negligence standard of
because
Lestina.
The statute was passed after Lestina.
Right.
Some would say in response to Lestina.
Yes. Mr. Nogler's office, Kara Burgos from his office, has done an excellent job, I think, and we've tried to do the same of looking coast to coast for authority on trying to find whether cheerleading has ever been considered a contact sport or a sport involving physical contact. We found soccer, softball, hockey, paintball, kick the can, football, but we have found no case anywhere at any level that is considered cheerleading to be a contact sport or a sport involving physical contact. So this would be a question of first impression were you to actually make that conclusion, I believe.
Do you believe that cheerleading involves physical contact?
I believe that cheerleading involves physical contact, yes.
Do cheerleaders get let? Never mind.
They get let.
That's outside the record, so
In reflection on one of the questions that was asked to Mr. Nogler, I remembered the Connecticut Supreme Court's explanation of why they considered recklessness a better standard than negligence in certain sports. And they said that the definition of those sports is when there's competition where the physical contact is expected to be with the opponent, and when you expect the spirit of play to involve some unintentional rule infractions, some perhaps unnecessary but unintentional force, that those are the sports where we want to raise the recklessness standard. And they also said that's why there are penalty boxes, foul shots, free kicks, and yellow cards. It's to a reasonable reader of this provision, it is intended to address those kinds of sports. It's not intended to go into a cheerleading situation. This is not as the Holman High cheerleading team was not one that was in cheerleading competitions. They were not training for some competition with other cheerleading squads. They were not in competition with anyone. And if you apply the statute to these facts, I think you are rendering as surplusage some of the language in the statute. It could have just said an activity that includes physical contact between persons in a sport. And that would have covered it. But they added involving amateur teams. And I think you take those words together, it clearly indicates that this covers competition and that is part of the rule of
law. Mr. Toole, do you think it's far-fetched to say the two basketball teams were going to be playing each other. Both basketball teams had their cheerleading squads there, and that there is indeed some competition between those cheerleading squads or teams as to which one performs the best? Is that really so far-fetched?
In my opinion, if that case ever comes to pass, I would argue that the statute does not apply to that, because I would suggest that the competition must be within the direct activity between the two teams. In other words, if they're just competing in how loud they can cheer for their two basketball teams, I don't think it's direct competition. But I would also say that that's a different case than this, and it's not one that's before this court today.
Jeff? Why, was there not a practice here going on before a basketball game?
Correct.
Does the record reflect that the opposing basketball team had its cheerleaders there?
I recall nothing from the record making that, establishing that fact, or establishing that the Holman High cheerleaders were in any way concerned about what the opponent cheerleaders were going to do.
This wasn't a competition between cheerleading groups.
This was not a competition.
Right, but that competition at the moment doesn't matter, you told me, because my hypothetical about the basketball team and the injury in practice wasn't a competition at the moment either, right?
I said that, in my opinion, the nature of the sport
right.
can define the inquiry,
right.
and that you would, if you are simply a Holman High cheerleader, where the nature of their sport does not involve any competition, it's not a spirit squad, you're not competitive with anyone, they don't enter any competitions. There's nothing in this record on this affirmative defense to support the fact that there was any competitor identified for this cheering squad.
The question asked by Justice Crooks really was in the line of my questioning regarding the word involving. You know, you have two teams there that are competing against each other, whether it be basketball or football or whatever, and then you have physical contact between a person in a sport involving. Why did they use involve? Let me make sure I understand your position. Are you contesting that this is a sport? As you, I just heard you earlier saying that it wasn't a sport, but now I just heard you say that it suggests that it was a sport. Is cheerleading a sport?
I would say that cheerleading often is a sport, depending on what they're doing. I would say it's not a contact sport, and I would say it's not a sport involving amateur teams based on what these students were doing.
Okay. I don't know. I don't... Let's look at the language of the statute. Is there physical contact between persons in cheerleading?
Yes.
That's what the statute reads, isn't it? Physical contact between persons in a sport. And if cheerleading can be or is a sport, seems like. Involving amateur teams. Does cheerleading involve amateur teams?
I would say certainly not in this case. And I think the involving amateur teams modifies sport. Sport involving amateur teams is my reading of that.
Sport. Yeah, amateur teams certainly modifies sport, but involving is just such an inclusive, you know, big word.
Well, I take it to mean that the legislature is saying we're not going to list off all of the possible sports that can be covered here, but we're going to give you a sense of what we mean. And I take that sense to be competition.
I think that's a fair enough interpretation. I'm just not sure it's the only interpretation. Understand?
Mm-hmm. If that's the case, counsel, why do they define recreational activity to include things like, oh, hunting, fishing, trapping, camping, bowling, picnicking? Where's the competition in picnicking?
At the time Lestina was decided, this provision that we're dealing with was not on the books, and so that the recreational immunity provision you're looking at now was interpreted in Lestina not to cover sports competition. The provisions were drafted at separate times, and when they drafted rec immunity, they were kind enough to put in that laundry list but maybe different legislators or different drafters didn't do that when they drafted this provision. Recklessness, very briefly, I've already touched upon it. The arguments Mr. Nogler makes sound like jury arguments to say, well, this guy was young, so he's not reckless. The law has never said that recklessness can never be applied to a minor. That's a fact that a jury could take into account in deciding recklessness. He says he wasn't trained. There's no law that says you have to be trained before you can be reckless. But that's another fact he could argue to the jury. Whether recklessness applies in this case is not a question that has been answered. I am not here to ask you to overturn a jury verdict against us. I'm asking you for an opportunity to present our case, let the jury decide whether liability should or should not be imposed. Thanks.
I'd like to ask you, if if you prevail on this part of the case, what will be the consequences? What are the implications for people involved in cheerleading?
A question Your Honor posed earlier, I think, to Ms. Van Horn regarding what about the fact that as the state of the law in this case is we have immunity for the school but no immunity for the cheerleader. It makes it tough. Cheerleading is a dangerous activity, and the tort system has always had some role to play in regulating dangerous activities. But the standard of care issue and resolving the standard of care is age-old, and so persons in our society will behave accordingly given the court's decision on that. But it certainly, in wrap-up, it certainly seems to me that there shouldn't be immunity for the school either, and I think that would help to insulate the cheerleader.
Thank you, Counsel. Mr. Nogler, you have 3 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you, Chief Justice. Let's deal first with the issue of teams. The rest of the phrase, and this is important because I think this is what the legislature is referring to, it says, involving amateur teams, including teams in recreational, municipal, high school, and college leagues. They're referring to teams. On the issue of Listina, I think the trial judge made a very good point. And he said, look, the legislature, which drafted this statute, is not bound or limited by the fact that they're addressing the issues raised in Listina, and they can write whatever reasonable statute they want. In this case, I think they've written a very clear one. Finally, on the issue of the chilling effect, which has come up here, and we do have a screwy standard, because now we have the case of everybody is going to have to ask themselves, or every parent of every daughter who wants to cheerlead, I mean, the same questions I asked at the outset of this. Can we afford the insurance? Can we afford the risk over something involving simple carelessness and over something in which the consequences can be very grave indeed? There have been no suits on cheerleading, probably because this is the first time it's come up. So this is a case of first impression. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. I want to thank all the counsel for their very interesting presentation in yet another case involving governmental immunity. I want to thank Mr. Toole, Ms. Van Horn, and Mr. Nogler. And that ends our hearing on 06 AP 1886, Nofke versus Bakke. The court is in recess until I